This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In a deadly dance of unbearable heat and extreme rains, people are looking for answers. Our guest, Chris Coker, is a recovering lawyer who founded Extreme Weather Survivors. You also hear from author-activist Bill McKibben and Kathy Mulvey from the Union of Concerned Scientists. Then tales from massive environmental protests in Europe you never heard about, with Swedish author and professor Andreas Malm. Tune in Voices of Climate Sanity this week on Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
This planet is still in the grips of an absolutely historic, mind-blowing band of heat too hot for humans and other life. Monkeys are dropping dead out of the trees, as are birds. On one side of the world, record-smashing heat stretches across the Americas from the South and Central America through Mexico into the southern U.S. states. The city of Phoenix issued ice-filled body bags to emergency responders trying to save lives in time. On the other side of the earth, Africa is crazy hot to the point where villagers in Algeria are rioting. In war-torn Gaza in the Middle East, it is worse. Jordan broke its June record, hitting 47.8 degrees last week. The heat in Iraq was over 50 degrees C across the country, only cooling to 30 or even 35 degrees C at night. That's over 120 degrees Fahrenheit by day, and just 86 to 95 degrees at night. Unbearable. You heard tourists are dying in Greece and nearby islands like Cyprus, where nighttime temperatures were still as high as 38 degrees C, 100 degrees Fahrenheit at 3:30 in the morning. According to weather historian Maximiliano Herrera, these are the hottest days ever in the southern Aegean and in the Rhodes Islands, not just in June, but ever. India continues with the longest, hottest days ever. New heat waves struck in China and Japan, setting more records there. It's not just the heat, of course. Record hot oceans result in more evaporation of water into the atmosphere. What goes up must come down, and it came down last week in Florida. Several inches of rain fell in a single hour. The deluge went on for 3 days. Cities from the western Gulf Coast like Sarasota to the Atlantic Coast, even Miami, suffered feet of water filling the streets and houses. The governor may ban all talk of climate change, but that doesn't stop extreme rains on a warming planet. Welcome to reality, Governor. Similar freak rains washed down and towns in Spain, striking southern Germany the week before. Flash floods are becoming the new normal. Bill McKibben, author and founder of 350.org, gives us a quick update on where we are. He spoke at a virtual panel on June 4, 2024, organized by the NGO Public Citizen. This roundtable examined criminal prosecution of big oil corporations for climate harms, including millions killed by climate-driven weather extremes. Here is Bill McKibben.
Let me just spend 2 minutes laying out the basic facts as we know them about the fossil fuel industry and climate change. I wrote what's often called the first book about climate change, though in those days we called it the greenhouse effect, back in 1989. At the time, we knew what was going to happen, but it hadn't happened yet. And scientists gave us fair warning of what would happen if we didn't cease to burn fossil fuel. When we didn't, when in fact we increased the rate at which we were burning it, producing more CO2 in the decades since the 1980s than in all of human history before, the inevitable thing began to happen. We have begun to see in real time the violent consequences of that rapid ramp up in temperature, and those continue to the day and to the hour. Right now, as we sit here talking, people in Asia are suffering through, in the biggest cities in the world, temperatures in the 120 degree range, and many of them are perishing as a result. The couple of things we know absolutely for certain are that this is caused overwhelmingly by the combustion of fossil fuels. When we burn them, we produce the gases that trap the heat in the atmosphere that would otherwise radiate back out to space. We know that we have alternatives to those fossil fuels, and we know that the fossil fuel industry knew that their product was causing this problem, and we know that the fossil fuel industry has done what it can to slow down the transition away from their product to the available economical and effective alternatives that are out there.
That was Bill McKibben on a virtual panel discussion organized by Public Citizen on June 4, 2024, recorded by Radio EcoShock. What happens when people burned out, flooded out, or burying relatives from climate-driven extreme weather find out they are all victims of the fossil fuel scam? Will we connect across the world and demand action? People who have lost loved ones and homes in hurricanes in the south had little connection to flood or fire victims in other parts of the country, or in the world, for that matter. Now we begin to recognize a common cause, record extremes caused by climate disruption. People are linking up through nonprofit groups like Extreme Weather Survivors, a new American advocacy group. Chris Kotcher is co-executive director of Extreme Weather Survivors. He describes himself as a realistic idealist, a recovering lawyer, and father. From Queens, New York, Chris Kotcher, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
What brought you into the fight to help organize millions affected by climate-driven disasters?
Well, I think that it is the most important issue of our time, and both as, you know, someone who is living now and has children and cares about my community and the world and the state of the world, I really recognize that working to support people who've been impacted by extreme weather disasters, but also support those who are ready to share their stories so that more and more Americans and really people around the world can understand that the impacts of climate change are here, they're happening now, and they're happening in communities across the country.
Fossil fuel supporters say, we always had storms and fires. This is just another woke excuse. How do you answer that?
Well, I would say talk to the people who are being devastated by extreme heat in Arizona, who are being devastated by flooding in communities across the country. What they tell me is that it's getting worse. It's never been like this before. I was just talking to someone yesterday in Phoenix. It's above 110 degrees there today, and they said to me it's never been like this in the first week of June. So I think if you are being realistic, you understand that the weather is changing. It's getting more extreme. It's getting more deadly. It's getting more costly. It's happening with more frequency, with more severity. And I think if you, you know, are not admitting that, then you're lying to yourself.
Well, yes, the newscasters always seem to find some older person who says, I've lived here 60 years and I've never seen it this hot this time of year, or I've never seen this place flood before. And this should be a real wake-up call for all of us. What do you think the difference is between natural disasters seen through all the ages and what we could call unnatural disasters in this new time of global warming?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really important distinction, and I think the language that you used is right. It's not natural, and that's, again, that's what people are saying to me that are experiencing this across the country. And I think if you look at the number of extreme weather disasters that are happening, the places that they're happening where they've never happened before, the severity with which they're happening, the frequency with which they're happening, and I think all of those things tell us that something is going on in the climate, and it's from the pollution that we're facing from oil and gas companies.
And I think we've crossed into a new constituency. Here on Radio EcoShock, most of our guests have been experts recording change and predicting worse to come. But as the hottest years with the most violent string of weather events arrive, now we hear from what used to be called climate victims. They want to call themselves climate survivors. Why not victims?
Well, I think that, you know, when you talk to folks, they feel like this is something that they're surviving. It's something, the reality that they're living with day in and day out. And survivor feels something that has a little bit more empowerment to it. And it reflects their reality, which is that they are dealing with a changing climate with more severe weather extremes that are happening in their communities that are impacting their loved ones. It's impacting their health. It's impacting their economic security. And it is something that they are surviving on a daily basis.
And we're hearing really strong voices develop out of this. Some people are angry and they're determined. A recent press event organized by Public Citizen and Chesapeake Climate Action Network, you spoke there, and it featured survivors from all over the country. They were very different people, experiencing everything from fires to floods, and they recognized each other and the climate cause. Is this almost, well, we could call it an environmental Me Too moment?
Well, I think there's something to that, and I think that people for too long have felt like that this is something that they are surviving and experiencing on their own. And part of what we want to do at Extreme Weather Survivors is help people make those connections. When you survived a flood, the heartbreaking reality is that you have an expertise in what it means to survive that flood, to rebuild your business, rebuild your home, navigate the insurance paperwork. And we want to help people feel less alone and more connected to others that are going through that. And, you know, the folks that I've talked to, they say to me, well, I want to make sure that I'm able to be part of the solution, not just to help fight for stronger climate policies, but also to support the communities and the people that are going to go through this in the future, which we know will happen. So people who have survived this, they want to help those that are going to go through this in the future feel less alone and have more support as they go through it to survive.
In a way, climate is a great leveler. Anyone of any race or background can have their homes or loved ones lost to superstorms, mega wildfires, or extreme rainfall flooding. Yet it seems the poorer people get hit hardest. They have the least voice in society and get pennies in aid, if anything at all. How do you see it, Chris?
Well, I think that there's a lot more work that we need to do to make sure that those communities that are most vulnerable, which are most more likely to be Black and brown communities, that they are on the front line of receiving support from government and relief efforts. And I think that there's a lot more work to be done there. And I think part of what we're seeing with some of the legislation, the Climate Superfund legislation and other efforts, is to make sure that when there are disaster relief efforts, that they are being distributed equitably and that they are going to the communities that are most in need of that support. If you're looking in the Gulf Coast, in Louisiana and Texas and Florida, often the communities that are most vulnerable to storms and flooding are those that have received the less investment, a small amount of investment from the government. And so we need to make sure that as additional funds are being made available to support relief efforts and building back in a way that makes the communities more resilient, that those resources are being directed to Black and brown communities and other communities that are especially vulnerable.
And in the past, you've helped people who are suffering through long COVID. And part of the problem of organizing people with a disease like that is that they're tired and they may be feeling mentally foggy and they feel a bit broken by the whole experience. So it's hard to organize people who don't feel well. And here again with the climate extreme weather situation, you have people who can be in trauma. They can feel very tired. They feel defeated. And so it seems to me that the stronger, more resilient people, the people who do develop a voice, really have to speak for many, many times more people who can't participate because they've been hurt so badly. How do you see that situation?
Sure. Well, you know, we know that 9 out of 10 Americans are already saying that they are surviving extreme weather disasters, and then it's impacting their lives and their families and their communities. So part of what we are hoping to do at Extreme Weather Survivors is to connect to more and more communities across the country and to really strengthen that movement of people who have been directly impacted so that we can make this conversation about extreme weather, about climate change, about people, and make more and more Americans realize that it's happening now. Like you said before, these are not natural disasters. They're unnatural. And so we want to make sure that as people are being impacted, they are able to tap into this community of people who have been impacted so that they can connect and have access to resources. You know, we offer free mental health resources, support groups in English and Spanish, so that when people are devastated by these disasters, they're not starting from zero. They're able to tap into a community of support. They're able to access mental health resources, and they're able to connect to people who can help them navigate that relief process. And I think that that's part of how, you know, you build a stronger, more resilient, more effective community of people who are pushing for this change.
And yet the threat of climate change is pretty quiet in the upcoming U.S. elections. It was more evident in the recent EU elections. How long until those damaged by climate become active, committed voters demanding change? Any ideas?
I would say that people are talking about it now, and I think, you know, after last summer and the extreme heat that people experienced in the Southwest, the air pollution that we experienced in the Northeast for the first time in quite some time, the wildfires that happened with more severity and frequency out west, I think people are seeing it now, and I think absolutely this is something that people will be voting on in this election and recognizing, you know, that President Biden has been really strong on this issue.
And Chris Kotcher, what was your idea in setting up the group Extreme Weather Survivors, and who was in it with you?
Like I said, you know, this is something that I've heard from people who have been through this, and as we were talking to them, this feeling of being alone in that recovery. And I recognize from the work that I've done supporting COVID survivors and in gun violence prevention, that connecting with people who have been through a similar disaster is a really important part of the recovery, and that supporting people who are interested in sharing their story to be part of that effort to push for stronger climate policy is a really important part of people's mental health healing. And so working with, you know, my colleague Sierra Koss and others around the country to think through how we can take the learning of those other groups and bring them into this space and adapt them here so that we can provide those free support groups and other resources to really make sure that people are able to connect with each other in a way that's good for their healing, but also for those that are interested in speaking out, that they have that opportunity to share their story to make change happen in the push for stronger climate policies.
Who's your co-executive director?
I'm the co-executive director, working with Sierra Koss, who's my other co-executive director. We founded this organization early this year, and we're working together with others around the country on this effort.
And what kind of services can you offer people so far? I realize you're just in the starting changes, but people who are trying to survive the big changes due to extreme weather.
Yeah, we offer services such as support groups that people can connect to in English and Spanish. We have a nationwide network of mental health professionals that we're working with to stand up those groups. And then we also work with other experts, child psychologists and other experts to bring in, have conversations and psychoeducational learnings about what it means to be parenting, for example, through extreme heat in the Southwest, and how parents can do a better job of supporting their kids, talking to their kids about the disasters that they're experiencing. I mean, I think one of the things that really stuck with me when I was recently talking to some folks that had their homes devastated by flooding, and their businesses devastated by flooding, was this question around, you know, how do I talk to my kids about this? How can I make sure that they know what we're going through, the economic insecurity that we're facing because of this flooding, without making them, you know, worried about this? So thinking through how we can provide programs like that to support people is a really important part of what we'll be doing as well. And like I said, offering webinars about what trauma is and how to recover and heal from trauma and connect with others. We've already started that last year and are continuing to offer that in the future.
I'm glad you're getting going on that, because I hear people still cry years later, triggered by a small loss like a treasure from grandma gone in the disasters. And governments and industry talk about adapting, but part of that has to be the mental health and support needs of those victimized by fossil fuel companies. Is there signs of more of that?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's a big part of what we feel like we can bring into this space. We plan to work, like I said, with our nationwide network of mental health professionals so that we can build spaces that are safe for people online, where people can connect with each other, share their experiences, share their losses, and have that peer support to hear from others who have been through something similar, while also recognizing that, you know, losses from wildfires is different, maybe somewhat different from flooding and from extreme heat. And so I think part of this is also just building a new language of grief and loss around extreme weather so that people can see themselves and build and connect into a community that has that shared experience. I think, you know, making sure we're doing that with mental health professionals in a safe, secure online space is really important.
And in survivor stories after the event, we hear frustration dealing with government agencies and insurance companies. People may be driven from their home in scary circumstances, and then they have to face a lot of forms and sometimes years of waiting for any help or restoration. It's an arcane bureaucracy at times. I wonder, first of all, is there somebody who helps people navigate that bureaucracy? And secondly, can we speed it up and make restoration really much faster than it is?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, when you have been through something catastrophic, like flooding that takes away your home or your business, Making sure that people have access to the resources and the help that they need as quickly as possible is incredibly important. And so I think that's a really important part of the conversation. And I think, you know, our part will be building that community of people who can help others that will be impacted in the future navigate by understanding, here's how the process works, here's how you fill out this paperwork, here's what I learned by going through that myself. And I think, you know, building that community so that people can tap into that expertise of how do you build after a disaster, after a flood, but then also making sure that people, you know, that we're advocating to make sure that those, that that process has as few obstacles as possible.
And I know this is the obvious question, but why don't the companies making trillions of dollars filling the sky with carbon pay for the damage they knowingly caused for profits?
Well, I think that's a really important question. And I think, you know, we just saw in Vermont earlier this month that, you know, the legislature there passed the Climate Superfund bill and to do just that, make sure that big oil and gas companies are paying their share of the damages and that those damages are going to the communities that have been devastated by extreme weather disasters so that they have the resources they need in the future to build back with more resiliency. And I think that's a really important part of the conversation. And as I'm talking to folks around the country who have survived these disasters, that's what I'm hearing from them. And that's part of why, you know, they want to be involved in this effort to share their stories to help more Americans understand what the reality of extreme weather is in this country today.
Well, tell us a couple of the stories you hear.
I mean, I can tell you, she spoke on the press call yesterday, but I think of Jenny from Vermont, who is someone who her business was flooded. And she's a single mom of three kids, poured her savings into starting this business a couple of years ago. And the flooding has left her with more than $160,000 in losses, which, if you know, just imagine that, you know, trying to parent as a single mom of three kids and trying to navigate and survive those kinds of severe financial losses. So I think a lot about her story. I think about, you know, folks that I've spoken with in the Southwest. Spoke with someone a few weeks ago, and it really struck with me. Went out to get the mail and passed out on the sidewalk and received second or third degree burns from just being on the sidewalk for a handful of minutes because the sidewalk was so hot and so much hotter than it's ever been before. Thinking about the man who had to put his daughters in the car at night when the AC broke so that they didn't pass out from the heat, and the only way that he could keep them cool was just driving around all night. So I think, you know, for me, I think about the stories, and as a parent myself, I think about the stories of other parents, small kids who are trying to navigate this new reality without much support, without much understanding of what the health consequences are. And I think the weather is changing faster than anyone, you know, even potentially realized as an everyday American. And so I think that that's why when we think about extreme weather survivors, making sure that we're really thinking about providing some of those, that support in that community for parents, for pregnant women, and for others who are really trying to navigate this new reality.
And we hope similar climate survivor groups will show up all over the world. Chris, have you heard of similar groups in other countries?
I haven't heard of them, but I have heard from people who have shared with me that they think, and of course we completely agree, that something like this is important around the world. And I think that is part of where we hope to build in the long term, which is to make sure that regardless of where you are, whether in the United States or in other countries, that you have access to programs and resources at no cost like the ones that we're building at Extreme Weather Survivors.
Is it your sense that climate survivors you talk with are aware of the direct role of fossil fuel companies producing greenhouse gas emissions? Do they know why these disasters are happening and sometimes repeatedly happening?
From what I have heard, I think that that is something that I have definitely heard from people. I think, you know, thinking about the business owners in Vermont who I spoke with, what I heard time and time again was this feeling that it was unfair. It was unfair that they were bearing the sole burden of this cost. It was unfair that oil and gas companies were making record profits and that they were talking about fairness. And that really resonated with me and felt really important for others to hear. It's unfair that oil and gas companies are raking in record profits while business owners while everyday Americans, you know, dealing with the extreme heat, are navigating and dealing with the cost of those disasters on their own.
Well, suppose my home is just burned out, or my relatives or flooded. How do I get in touch with your group, and what happens then?
Absolutely. You can go to www.extremeweathersurvivors.org and sign up for our email list there, and we send out regular communications with information about the free resources that we offer. We'll be launching our next round of support groups and trauma resource trainings in the fall in September. We'll be doing another series this December around the holidays, and we offer other trainings periodically throughout the year as well.
From Queens, New York, we've been speaking with Chris Kotcher. He is co-executive director of Extreme Weather Survivors. You can find links to connect and follow up in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org, or just go directly to www.extremeweathersurvivors.org. Chris, thank you for talking with our listeners.
Thanks so much. I appreciate being here.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Getting back to that public citizen roundtable on criminal prosecution of big oil, author and activist Bill McKibben raises the key question: how can anyone prove particular fossil fuel products led to deaths or injuries? Can we make the links between the wells and refineries all the way to seniors falling dead in the heat or families drowned in record floods? Kathy Mulvey answers. She is Accountability Campaign Director for the Union of Concerned Scientists.
One of the questions that's going to automatically come up, in a sort of foundational question, it seems to me, is this question of attribution. How do we connect particular deaths to the heat and or flood or storm, and how do we connect those things to the actions of the companies in question? Kathy, give us this is a fast developing science, but one that's now remarkably robust and that operates quite quickly often. Give us a sense on how developments in climate attribution and other social science bear on this question.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Bill. So, you know, in broad strokes, attribution science identifies and quantifies human contributions to climate change and its related impacts. And it's a relatively new and rapidly evolving field. And really there are four subfields. One is trend attribution, which is really understanding the human role in climate change using indicators like temperature increase. Another, which I think is what comes to mind for many people when we hear about attribution science, is event attribution. And this is a new and rapidly evolving field, and really the most straightforward impacts and events are those that are most closely tied to temperature increases. So, you know, this would allow us to understand, for example, how climate change increased the likelihood or intensity of an event. Another subfield that's particularly critical here when we're thinking about big oil and the fossil fuel industry is source attribution, which quantifies how emissions from a data set of what's now 88 of the largest fossil fuel and cement corporations have contributed to global warming emissions and then to various climate change impacts. So from global average temperature increase to sea level rise, ocean acidification, and in one of the most recent studies, there are wildfires in the Western United States. And then another subfield is really impact attribution, understanding how many deaths in a heat wave or how much damage in a hurricane might be attributable to human-caused climate change. So, you know, these are the physical science attributes. I think it's really important to recognize that this goes hand in hand with social science, with research on disinformation and policy obstruction. I see, you know, Naomi Oreskes here in the audience. I mean, she's been one of the real leaders in publishing how ExxonMobil and other fossil fuel companies have really spread disinformation, constrained our options, and that evidence certainly is going to also be critically important as prosecutors look at pursuing these kinds of claims.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
We return to the question, how can we prove fossil fuel companies recklessly cause deaths for big profits? Following a question by Bill McKibben, Aaron Regenberg from Public Citizen addresses the legal case.
Talking about the challenges to a prosecution, I do think that this causation question is, it's certainly what I think a lot of people have an initial gut skepticism about legally. And certainly it's what the legions of big oil lawyers are going to attack, right? Every stage. So to show causation in a case like this, you need to sort of show the causal state chain at three stages. You need to show that this particular death or injury was caused by this weather event. You need to, or substantially caused by, you need to show that this weather event was substantially caused by climate, and then you need to show that climate was substantially caused by these particular defendants. And so they're certainly going to go after every leg of that. We think that there are some very, very strong arguments at every leg of that, certainly in showing that climate caused these events, and then for showing that these companies caused climate. Kathy mentioned the source attribution. You know, companies are going to say that, well, you can't hold us legally accountable because we're not the only actors that have contributed to climate change. As David described, in most jurisdictions, you don't need to be the only. You need to be a substantial contributing factor. And so it's hard to know, you know, there's not currently case law for in a criminal case what counts as a substantial contributing factor. There are some relevant civil precedents. In, for example, Massachusetts v. EPA, the U.S. Supreme Court said that in cases alleging climate-related harms, a causal connection exists where the emissions, quote, make a meaningful contribution to greenhouse gas contributions and hence to global warming. They found that 6% in that case was meaningful. In another case, Connecticut v. American Electric Power Company, they found 2.5%. That was a different context than a criminal prosecution. It would be a higher standard, but certainly we're talking about an order of magnitude more of a contribution than that with the, you know, top 6, 7, 8 investor-owned fossil fuel companies. Last thing I'll just say that there, oil companies are also going to try to argue that on causation that it's not them, it's consumers, right? We've already heard just a couple months ago, we all remember Darren Woods, ExxonMobil CEO, was saying it's the public's fault, it's not us. And that, I think it's useful to note, as a legal defense, that is not going to fly, right? For legally, that amounts to an argument that consumers' end-stage emissions constitute an intervening cause that breaks the chain of causation. And in every jurisdiction, to absolve a defendant of criminal liability, the intervening conduct needs to be unforeseeable, reasonably unforeseeable. And I think it's going to be very hard for big oil to convince a judge or jury that they did not foresee that consumers would use their products precisely as they were intended to be used, and indeed precisely as they engaged in deceit in order to get people to keep using so they wouldn't understand the risks.
You just heard from Kathy Mulvey speaking about attribution. She's with the Union of Concerned Scientists on June 4th. Aaron Regenberg is the Senior Policy Counsel at Public Citizens Climate Program. He has a follow-up on that case against fossil fuel companies. He weighs the obstacles and opportunities to finally get climate justice.
As Clinton said, I'm a Senior Policy Counsel with Public Citizen, and I'm just here to help us close out because as has been stated by all of our speakers, the disasters that have endangered Patrice and Deborah and Jenny and Rashetta and Alan, that have destroyed homes and ruined livelihoods and taken lives in communities all across the country. These disasters didn't just happen out of the blue, right? They were foreseeable and in fact foreseen consequences of decisions made by a small number of fossil fuel companies that knowingly generated a substantial portion of all global greenhouse gas emissions and fraudulently deceive the public so they could continue to generate emissions and heat up the planet. In other words, these are not just tragedies that we're hearing about today. These are harms that were forced on innocent people by sophisticated corporate actors that were aware of and consciously disregarded how their conduct would result in exactly the kinds of injuries that we've heard about today. And let's be clear, if any of us had engaged in knowing or reckless conduct that led to Alan's home getting burned down, or Jenny's business getting destroyed, or the endangerment of Patrice's health, you can bet that we would face consequences for our misbehavior, right? Whether through civil litigation or criminal prosecution or other public programs. And we're here to say that those principles legally apply to big oil companies in the exact same way. The victims and survivors of climate disasters deserve justice and accountability. And fortunately, we have mechanisms to give it to them, right? We have new legislative proposals like the climate superfund bills that have been introduced in a number of states, one of which was just signed into law in Vermont. We have the civil justice system, which is designed to repair harms and compensate those who have been injured. And that's precisely the goal of the dozens of climate accountability suits that have been filed by local and state jurisdictions all across the country, seeking damages and other forms of relief, like consumer protection measures to stop big oil from continuing to lie. And we also have the criminal justice system, which is designed to protect citizens from harm and hold wrongdoers accountable. And Public Citizen, along with a growing network of former prosecutors and other legal advocates, believe that a strong case exists that major fossil fuel companies have committed crimes like reckless endangerment for contributing to climate disasters, like criminal destruction of property for climate losses, like fraud, conspiracy, and racketeering for deceiving the public, and like reckless homicide for causing climate-related deaths. So as we head now into another summer of lethal heat waves and wildfires and hurricanes and other climate-fueled catastrophes, we think it's really important to remember every time a disaster strikes that we have solutions that can provide climate survivors with restitution and accountability from the actors responsible. It is just a matter of whether or not we're willing to stand up and fight for the justice that these victims need and deserve.
That was Aaron Regenberg from Public Citizen, recorded in a panel June 4th, 2024. And now, on to Andreas Malm. The European Save the Climate movement is more advanced. In this supposedly connected world, most people in North America never hear about it. We are about to explore a new front for environmental concern, climate adaptation measures forced by big government on behalf of megacorporations only. Take France, where an estimated 30,000 people showed up in March 2023 to protest the construction of a massive water reservoir. They were beaten and gassed by thousands of police. The reservoir, a human-made lake, is filled by pumping up groundwater. The water will go to large agribusiness fields to make up for the shortfall because of heat and drought caused by global warming. Ironically, as the world warms, water that was protected underground is now exposed in mega basin lakes to evaporation. More water is lost with every tenth of a degree of warming. The super reservoirs are also open to bacteria and other pollution. Meanwhile, the groundwater, used by small farmers and nature itself, remember nature, is sucked up for corporate benefit. It is a climate solution only a capitalist militarized state could love. The location is Saint-Soline, where a reservoir is planned, an artificial lake surrounded by walls 8 feet high. French groups like the collective Bassines Non Merci et Les Soulèvements de la Terre, meaning the Earth's uprising, and the Confederation Paysan oppose the construction of this and about 30 more grand reservoirs plan for France in a hotter planet.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Our tour guide is the Swedish author Andreas Malm. He is Associate Professor of Human Ecology at Lund University. Andreas has also been called a Marxist. His 2021 book, How to Blow Up a Pipeline, Learning to Fight a World on Fire, has been adapted to a film of the same name. Asked for an interview here on Radio EcoShock, Dr. Malm declined, citing heavy commitments already to teaching and writing. He is not doing interviews currently. So we hear Andreas Malm's presentation to the 2023 conference called The Failure of Green Capitalism, Findings, Objectives, Alternatives. That was held September 15th, 2023. Malm's title for his talk is Overshoot, Climate Politics When It's Too Late. In this 12-minute audio selection, Andreas refers to the German environmental group Ende Gelände, translated as Here and No Further. This civil disobedience group has occupied coal mines in Germany, raising the issues of climate justice. They protested coal mining and fracking in Poland, the Netherlands, and the Czech Republic. Malm thinks Ende Gelände is the most inspiring environmental protest group in Europe, noting that Germany, like Sweden, is not a place where a lot of social struggle happens in this way. But he now thinks the German movement has been surpassed by the French groups fighting mega reservoirs. The French groups brought out about 30,000 people against one reservoir, which are called mega basins, and that was in March 2023. Malm estimates that is about three times bigger than the largest protest camp organized by that German group Ende Gelände. He says this is the first but not the last protest against adaptation projects in Europe. But France is the one country in Europe that has a history of protest actions in the streets. Malm says the French groups have, quote, opened a new front in climate politics in Europe, end quote. The new environmental threat may be human reaction to climate threats, odd to think. It is important to tune into this, though. Now, with the world doing nothing to control global warming, the climate movement faces multiplying fronts needing action, Malm warns. We begin in mid-speech, talking about the state industrial complex, he says.
What is said here is that, okay, this is a fact of life. We now have climate change. There's nothing to do about it. So we have to adapt, and we have to have better systems in place for evacuating people, warning them, and not building in the wrong places, and so on and so forth. This ideology, we call it muscular adaptationism, as a kind of a subset of overshoot ideology, is now starting to circulate more and more. Wall Street Journal ran a piece the other day, following in the wake of the devastating fires in Hawaii, with the headline, How Better Tech Could Save Lives in a World of Bigger, Faster, More Devastating Fires. I'm going to read briefly again. A wide array of new technologies are being tested and deployed that can alert authorities minutes after a fire starts. These include tower-mounted cameras that use artificial intelligence to identify smoke and sensors that are installed just above the forest floor, sniffing out fires using a kind of electronic noise. Collectively, these fire prevention and fire detection systems have the potential to be stitched into comprehensive fire intelligence networks. Already, early versions of these networks are rapidly informing the actions of firefighters. In the future, they might generate alerts that help us all cope with wildfires. Fires are bigger, hotter, and more devastating, and the number of megafires that scorch more than 100,000 acres has increased sharply in the past decade. There is evidence that early detection of fires is one of the most cost-effective ways to tackle the problem of dangerous wildfires. Yeah, and we've seen this in closer to home as well. Here, last year after the extreme wildfires in France, Emmanuel Macron went out and said, in a lull in the firefighting. I quote, "We beat the beast that is these wildfires, and now we're going to have a major national project of reconstruction. We're going to stabilize the fire, go after the victory, and rebuild. We will have to adapt our concepts of civil security with more protective rules, a long-term prevention plan." And then Macron called for a larger fleet of firefighters. And I don't know if you remember, but 2 years ago when you had the very bad flooding here in Germany, Angela Merkel gave a speech on the site where she said, "Germany is a strong country. We will stand up to this force of nature in the short term, but also in the medium and long term." And then she called for various measures for adapting better to these kind of floods, with, of course, the preface, "Germany is a strong country." And you see this kind of rhetoric returning in many places, that we can defeat this nature that is coming at us if we mobilize our technologies, and it's often merged with some kind of vaguely patriotic, nationalistic, quasi-militaristic idea that if we only get our act together and beef up enough force and muscle, we're going to be able to weather this situation. Of course, the general picture that you get here is that capitalist societies can envision combating the symptoms while allowing the drivers of global heating to speed uncontrollably ahead. And in none of these moments that I've just referred to have the immediate disasters prompted any kind of initiatives for radicalized mitigation. Instead, the reflexive reaction to these disasters is, "Ow, this is happening, we're going to have to adapt." And the problem here, of course, is that, okay, when the real incentives to mitigation start showing up, they're not interpreted as such, but interpreted as incentives to adaptation. So if people are not sort of realizing that we have to get rid of fossil fuels in the moment of disaster, when are they ever going to realize it? You see what I mean? Yeah. And instead, the talk becomes focused on adaptation, which, of course, it's needed, but there's a massive illusion at work here. The illusion that, okay, if we only get these intelligent firefighting networks in place, we can cope with constantly rising temperatures. Or if we only get more firefighters to bomb the conflagrations in southern France, we can live with it. But, of course, in this arms race between human technology and unmitigated global warming, humans are destined to be defeated, because I can't see anywhere how you can continuously build up greater technological force to keep the constantly growing disasters in check. And then the third problem with this is the problem that a lot of this will probably be maladaptation. In France, we've had a very politically interesting situation over the past half year, where I think we've seen the first major social struggle around an adaptation project. And I'm thinking of Le Soulèvement de la Terre and its campaign against the mega bassin. The mega bassin, the mega reservoirs, are a very strange phenomenon that I don't know of from anywhere else than in France. And what they do is that it's large agro-business companies who build giant tanks or water reservoirs into which they pump groundwater and keep it for irrigating their very large fields. And this is designed and advertised as a measure of adaptation to growing scarcity of water in the French countryside. So this is large agribusiness adapting to the difficulty of finding enough water to irrigate their fields by extracting groundwater and concentrating it, centralizing it in these giant, giant tanks. And this has, unsurprisingly, provoked a lot of anger on the French countryside, because what they mean is that small farmers are deprived of runoff and groundwater, which is instead then centralized in reservoirs where, of course, due to the increasing temperatures, this water tends to evaporate very fast. So it's a very suboptimal way of dealing with increasingly scarce water, to put it in large reservoirs where it evaporates in the heat. And And we've had a movement, Le Soulèvement de la Terre, which has fought consistently with allies in the peasant movement and elsewhere in the social movement landscape in France against these megabassins. This movement is very interesting for many reasons. One is that I think now it actually outshines in the Gelände. I mean, for a long time I've always seen Germany as the home of the most inspiring climate movement in Europe, and I've always considered this a paradox because Germany, like Sweden, is generally not a place where a lot of social struggle happens, whereas France is the one country in Europe that has a living tradition of social discontent on the streets. So I've always considered this a paradox because the climate movement has generally been stronger in Germany than in France. Now I would say that France has actually caught up and left Germany behind because Le Soulèvement de la Terre is far eclipsing in the Gelände in terms of how many people they get into their actions and the level of mass militancy that movement has demonstrated. Another very interesting difference is that while in the Gelände has focused on the lignite mine, so mitigation essentially, some of the central struggles waged by Le Soulèvement de la Terre haven't been about mitigation but about adaptation, which marks the arrival of a new front in climate politics in Europe. And this is from the most famous action that Le Soulèvement de la Terre has undertaken, namely the one against the megabassin in Sainte-Soline on the 25th of March this year, when about 30,000 people, which is, I think, more than three times as many as in the largest Ende Gelände camp, something like 30,000 people marched against the megabassin under construction and were met with the most extreme imaginable police brutality that you can think of in Western Europe, at least. I mean, you know, you can go to other countries in other parts of the world and you wouldn't be surprised, but even in France, which is not a foreigner or a stranger to riots and police brutality, people were absolutely shocked by the ferocity of the militarized response, with something like 5,500 grenades of various kinds fired by the police against the demonstrators and the in something like an hour and a half. And this then was followed by attempts by the Interior Ministry in France to ban and dissolve the Soulèvement de la Terre, which is now upheld in court. And it really brought the struggle around the megabassin to the forefront of the French political agenda. Now, I would think that this is the first but not the last struggle around adaptation projects in Europe and elsewhere. I think that when you see attempts to deal with the scarcity of resources, perhaps water in particular, you will see these kind of maladaptive projects where large businesses, more or less in conjunction with a militarized state, deal with approaching scarcity by trying to appropriate and control the resources in question and thereby exclude others from them, and that this leads to indignation and protest from people who are excluded from these resources. I think that in Europe it's not coincidental that we see these struggles first in what is essentially part of Southern Europe, because nowadays, in the summers, the north-south axis is pretty extremely pronounced, and Southern Europe is in a far worse state than Northern Europe. This can, of course, change, but in my country, Sweden, for instance, we haven't had a really bad summer since 2018, while the summers in Italy and France and Greece tend to get worse and worse, not to mention Spain and Portugal. And water, of course, is a key resource here, and the total failure to do anything about global warming means that we'll have more problems of water scarcity in areas such as Southern Europe, and we are likely to see more contention around projects to safeguard water resources for big companies such as the large agro-industrial companies that are dominating in the French countryside. So one provisional hypothesis here is that within the overshoot conjuncture, the fronts for climate politics multiply. So we are forced to wage struggles other than those that concern mitigation. Unfortunately, and this is sort of the tragedy of the overshoot conjuncture, that it imposes on us a situation where we have to deal with other as well. So not only the coal mines in Germany, but also these water reservoirs in France, and who knows what the future will hold.
That was Swedish author and professor Andreas Malm speaking September 15th, 2023 on Overshoot, Climate Politics When It's Too Late. Find a link to that YouTube video in my show blog at ecoshock.org. So there were so-called violent protests against water reservoirs in southern France reported April 4th, 2023 in Le Monde. The protest was March 24th to 26th in Sainte-Soline. Al Jazeera reports more than 25,000 people attending the protest. Le Monde characterizes it as an illegal demonstration against a massive water reserve project. Over 200 people were hurt, some seriously. One remains in a coma, the last I've heard. Police discharged more than 5,000 tear gas canisters at the crowd. Mega basin water storage has also been built in Chile and other countries. The Chilean ones tend to benefit large export farming operations like avocados rather than local farmers. Some villages in Chile ran out of water in the drought but were not allowed to tap into the big reserves. Corporations only. Locals say, no es sequía, es saquerol. It is not drought, it is looting. That is the slogan in Chile. Indigenous people in Mexico are also protesting giant reservoirs. Internationally, mega corporations like Coca-Cola or Nestle get access to the water. In France, the Fondation Daniel Mitterrand is making an international call, saying, we are water defending itself. It includes over, quote, 300 peasant, indigenous, environmentalist, feminist, and trade union organizations from all over the world, end quote. Al Jazeera notes, opponents say that these huge artificial water reservoirs privatize a common resource for the benefit of intensive, production-driven methods of agriculture that refuse to question its method in light of climate change, end quote. More protests erupted on October 29th and 30th, 2023. Both police and protesters were injured. The protests have been prohibited. Five people were put on trial in western France for them. They were tried in November 2023. So here we are. Rich agricultural areas with mass farming technology faces climate-driven water shortages and increased need for irrigation in the heat. Their lobby groups and the government respond with even more technology to pump out groundwater, common to all, to save up for the privileged corporations. Even if thousands of people object, thousands more police appear to gas and beat them. We enter the age of climate adaptation by force for the few. That is the new climate front, according to Andreas Malm. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock. Given all the mega threats around, frankly, Pilgrim, I don't like your chances. Neither does the Canadian government. Pulling no punches, their recent report is called Disruptions on the Horizon. It's pretty scary. The top 10 disruptions with the highest combined likelihood and impact are: people cannot tell what is true and what is not. Possible within 3 years. Biodiversity is lost and ecosystems collapse. Likely within 7 years. Emergency response is overwhelmed. Maybe within 6 years. Cyber attacks disable critical infrastructure. 4 years. Billionaires run the world. Within 5 years. Artificial intelligence runs wild. Possible within 6 years. Vital natural resources are scarce. Within 8 years. Downward social mobility is the norm. Within 5 years. Healthcare systems collapse. Within 6 years, maybe. Democratic systems break down. Possible within 6 years. Of course, I think some of these are already happening, and they're much more likely to happen sooner than that. We don't know for sure. The Disruptions on the Horizon report was created by Policy Horizons Canada. The authors say, quote, "While the disruptions in this report are not guaranteed to take place, they are plausible, and overlooking them may carry risks in various policy areas." They add, quote, "One disruption could have cascading implications in unexpected areas, and the occurrence of one disruption could set off others." Find a link to their full report in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening again this week and caring about our world.
If you knew that he was coming, the main moment.